We have just loved being with you. We can't tell you how much our hearts overflow with gratitude. Just to touch the lives of some of you, see some of you, sense your presence. But the corporate spirit of all of you, really marvelous. And we want to thank God and thank you for this delightful experience. We've been here before, twice and three times. She three, me one, two. But because you are such a marvelous group, I will not tell you about the time I began courting Marge. I was getting kind of enthused one night and said, I really love you. And I got warmed up and I kept adding words and enthusiasms and passion. Till finally I blurted out, I wish I were an octopus with eight arms to hold you. You know what she said? I don't believe it. You aren't even using the two you've got. And being of a brilliant Scandinavian mind, I wanted to have a unique way of proposing to her, also a bit frightened, so I finally one night whispered, would you like to be buried in our family plot? Since I'm Scandinavian, I asked an old pastor to have our service in Texas. And lights weren't so good, and he flipped. As you recall, the baptismal service is next to the marriage service. He flipped the page and said, dost thou renounce this devil and all his works? And she did. She didn't turn it down. So she suffered and suffered and suffered. She told me the reason she married me was that her mother liked me and she had two younger sisters. To save them from such a cruel fate, she volunteered. So if you want to give her a hand now, all the suffering of the last years. Well, we'd better start. Remember the city cousin had a country cousin come to visit him in church, and he explained all the things that happened. Pastor took his watch off. What does it mean? City cousin said, doesn't mean a thing. Okay. Will someone lead us in a prayer? We're going to begin. I'm Erling Wold, the second in a sequence of two on the Divine Frolic, or the Dancing Servant. Will someone lead us in a prayer? We began with the story of creation, as Frost said, is the story of a divine frolic in that the Father is preparing a treasure hunt for his children. We talked about the bubbling laughter and joy that bursts across the whole Old Testament and through the New. In stories like Abraham and Sarah, story of creation, the giving of Eve to Adam, the 300 invitations to wild laughter in the Psalms, the story of the prodigal son where the father brings in an orchestra, provides the finest foods available, and all the rest of it, Revelation throbbing with music, and that the preacel or bishop in the Middle Ages was the leader of the dance. And the Bible is full of this. And so I said, the picture we often have is the one our children sing. We are climbing Jacob's ladder. But that's totally unbiblical, because that's struggling, that's selfishness, that's climbing over others, that's self-attainment. It isn't grace. So I suggested we have Sarah's circle and talked about a circle with, what did we call them? The streamers?
A maypole.
Maypole. Who's at the center of the maypole? One person.
Christ.
Fascinated by Jesus. You never get your eyes off him. Yeah. And that the Spirit permeates his fellowship, floods it, motivates it, fills it. And that he wants you passionate, which means burning inside. Now, before I begin, I want just to quote something from Horace Bushnell. Martin Marty says he is the most brilliant theologian preacher in the 19th century in America. And this man said, as childhood begins with play, so the last end of humans, the pure ideal in which humans are consummated, is a state of play. If we look for this perfected state, we shall find it nowhere save in religion. Here at last, a person is truly and completely a person. Here the dry world of work and the scarcely less dry counterfeits of play are left behind. Partial inspirations no longer suffice. The man ascends into a state of free beauty, where well-being is its own end and joy. When life is a simple flow of love and thought, no longer colored in the primatic hues of prejudice and sin, but rejoices ever in the clear white light of truth. Exactly this we mean when we say that Christianity brings an offer of liberty to humans. For the Christian liberty is only pure spiritual play, delivered of self-love, fear, contrivance, legal constraints, termagant passions, in a word, of all ulterior ends, not found in goodness itself. The man ascends into power and reveals for the first time the real greatness of his nature, and it has to do with circles. We're in a circle. We're hand to hand. What's the most important organ of your body? Heart, you think. What's the largest organ in your body?
Liver.
Skin.
Skin. You're brilliant. How much of you is skin? 17%. Yeah. We had a brilliant psychiatric nurse at UCLA's Medical Center who said she worked with babies born with traumas and difficulties for life. And she said, if those babies aren't touched and loved from the first moments, many have terrifying results in the end. Some die. There's a book called Touching by Donna
Ashley Montague.
Montague, who says monkeys, for example, of a certain type, if they aren't licked by mother when they're born, they never make it. Skin is for touching. Hand in hand. We meet someone, we touch them. What does that do? For those who follow you in the circle. Why do you shake hands?
For connection.
Connection, yeah. More.
Bonding.
Bonding, yeah. We're tied together. We're brother and sister.
Usually spreads goodwill.
It spreads goodwill.
It's an acknowledgement of someone else.
Acknowledging somebody else. More.
Affection.
Affection, more.
Warmth,
more.
Energy.
Energy flows. If you care about this person, you can tell. You squeeze it solidly. I did that once in North Hollywood. Woman came back next Sunday and said, you broke my finger. She meant it had gotten over the ring and it snapped out a joint, but she pulled it back into the joint. How to get out of a joint. Anybody else? When people slip. Remember that story about the kid who wanted to learn to walk? He said he could walk by himself. His dad offered him his hand, he wouldn't take it. The kid began to stumble. He gave him a finger, stumbled again, gave him two, ultimately gave him his whole hand. You know, we support when somebody stumbles. Holding hand, feeling touch. When we hug, what do we transmit?
Caring.
Yeah. When you meet someone, how close do you get to the person? If you don't know them.
About 6 foot.
arm's length.
Some say even 27 inches, but that close. Okay. I hadn't seen Richard for years. We were together at Luther College when we were students. I met him down South Texas. We met, we shook hands, we talked as if we had just been speaking 5 minutes before. There was no wall whatsoever. We could touch as brothers. It's kind of beautiful. But hugging transmits energy, transmits care, transmits the fact that you trust the other person, not going to knife you. I mentioned, yes.
Why is it though that some people, you know, if you're a hugger,
Yeah.
Which I am usually. Yep. How come some people make you back off from that? What happens?
Yeah. What do you think?
Personal space.
They want space. Why?
Too threatening.
Too threatening for some. I try to read people when they go through the church door, for example. You try to read them. Do they want to be touched? Do they want to be patted? Do they want to be hugged? Some do desperately. I mentioned one, I think, who hadn't been touched for 2 years. She asked me to hug her real good. She came from Wisconsin.
Come on now, Ron.
That's not nice.
No, it was real. No, she said, she came to church, she was there 2 years before, she said, hug me real good, hug me real good. She said, I haven't been touched since I was here last.
Wow. That's bad.
Yeah. Yes?
I think it's important, too, to give people's permission to touch them.
Yes, but how did you get that?
By asking them.
Asking them.
Yeah, I know that sounds like it's really stupid, but mm-hmm. I know sometimes it's helpful. Like, I used to do Meals on Wheels routes, and okay. some people didn't want to be touched, and others, I would ask them for permission, and I gave them the right to say yes or no.
But if you had 500 people coming out of your church door...
Oh, that would be a little different.
Yeah. So I tried to read them, because some look like they're reticent, but they really want to be. So I think I gamble on the fact that we ought to move. But it's a threat. I know to some people... who have been attacked or used or abused or just aren't sure. Huh?
Never had anybody go through a second time? She thought it was so great, she decided to come back and do it again. She wouldn't mind the second time.
I'm glad I have some attraction. Mari says, oh no. Hiding your face. I wouldn't blame her.
We have two young pastors at our church, and I believe they hug every person. Every person.
Almost. Yeah, no, it's okay. See, I think if everyone does, then they can go out the side door if they see it, I think. I mean, if it's a pattern, then nobody feels threatened. You're not, you know, I think that's possible.
And I really think it's the best, one thing that happens at our church.
Yeah.
Every little kid, every little brat, every little nice kid, they all hit a hug. Yeah. And I mean, they mean it. These preachers just don't do it. It's really a very good thing. It's not my nature to be that way, but I watch it lots of times, and I just marvel at what it does for people.
I used to watch children toward the end of my ministry in a parish, and I could almost read, since I knew the families, the kids that felt threatened and the kids who were hungry for affection. You could almost feel it, the way they hung on you, asked you, watched you, you know. That touch is absolutely essential. And 10 hugs a day minimum to survive. And all this happens to all of us. It's kind of like marriage, because in marriage you're sealed to each other. And Paul says you're called to belong. And in a sense, that should happen in a lesser sense in the congregation of God. That you're committed to each other, and this is a sign that you're one. But you're dancing, see, all the time when you move through the circle. Okay, next, eyeball to eyeball. Eyeballs are amazing. They have about 30 million parts. I remember when I first met Marge, she was working, just called to work for the president at Luther College. I was already working as a senior, she a freshman, for the vice president. First time I saw her, I fell right into the depths of her eyes. And I fell in love with her instantly. Very amazing thing. The eyes are the gates of the soul. They're the graduate school of the spirit. They can contain everything you are and have and can be. Someone can say, I hate you, when underneath they're really saying, I love you. You're an idiot. You don't even respond. But I think through eyes we transfer our real selves. We unveil the world inside us. And if you have a real living relationship, you transmit it through the eye gates through which your personality is visible. Now, is it difficult to have eyeball-to-eyeball contact? Do you ever have people look away from when they talk to you? Yeah, why?
Yeah.
Nervous, yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes you're afraid you're going to open up too much.
Could be.
Yeah. Why else?
Well,
yes.
Some of it's culture too.
Part of the culture. Mm-hmm.
But that is a closeness.
Yeah.
Looking eyeball to eyeball.
And does it cost you anything to have eyeball to eyeball contact?
It opens you up.
Yeah. What does that mean?
They can see into you as well.
And if they see into you, what could that demand of you? That you respond. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you see someone hurting, you know, maybe you better sit up with that person all night. It isn't cheap, you know.
Do you want to get involved is what?
Yes. Yeah. Eyeball means involvement. Yeah. It means intensity. You listen. Your best friends are those who listen to you so carefully that you can feel them hanging in you. Right? And that costs you your life. And I find myself looking away sometimes. Because you sense the pain, you hear the cries. You get at the heart of someone by doing that.
It's sometimes respectful to turn your eyes, though. If you know that someone is hurting that
too much. Yep.
That they aren't ready for that,
yep,
that connection.
Yeah. And sometimes you're thinking it's maybe too intense. You look away to get your thoughts back, for those that have any. And then, I meant to write all these on the board, I got it already. But you record mentally, it's no problem. And then, eyeball to eyeball, all equal. Luther's last words were always only beggars before God. Nobody's more important than the other person. I sure learned in the ministry that some layperson, maybe the most emaciated, most impossible-looking person in the congregation, maybe the number one saint. The first, last, last, first. Somebody who lifts the congregation is the one who's central. And that's why biblically there ain't no big shots. Everyone's totally equal there. An old story from England, when they still have some of those, a large fiefdom where one of the knighted persons had a whole acreage of property and his own chapel and pastor. And when late one afternoon the sun was going down, he went in to pray at the altar. One of his servants, a real semi-slave, came in the darkening gloom. He didn't see his boss. He knelt next to him. When he suddenly recognized him, he jerked to his feet, was going to run. And the boss said, "Stay, we're all equal here." Yeah. So what do you feel about churches where there is sometimes a setting apart of someone as if somebody in the service of the church is more significant than the other? When you see us dressed up in all our paraphernalia, regalia, why do we wear all of it? Why does the pastor have robes?
It's supposed to be a symbol.
Of what?
Of some ancient moorings to something.
Okay. Anybody? Why that... Oh, what's it for?
It's supposed to cover his humanity, isn't it?
I hope not.
But you're a minister of God?
Yeah. Sign of servants, servanthood. You're a slave. The only reason I wore gowns was it used to be that they weren't to measure you by your clothing. And it says in the Old Testament that God clothed people with his righteousness. It's a symbol that you're forgiven. It has nothing to do with authority. The only authority a pastor's got is what the congregation gives him. They ask him to be a teacher or a preacher. They could say, we'll dismiss you. We'll call a layperson. 70% of the Lutheran churches in the globe are led by lay people. And they're the fastest growing because people suddenly recognize they're important and significant.
I don't think the person in the pew has your interpretation.
What do they have?
Well, I think most people, particularly our parents and grandparents, wanted the robe so that you would be set apart as a pastor, because we want you to be seen as someone special and up here.
Anybody argue that? Do you think that's right?
I'm not agreeing.
No, I know. But I say, you think that's what people thought, think?
Yes. Oh, I don't know.
They don't think it anymore. I don't think.
I do.
Okay.
I do. I think that a lot of people still have that kind of concept with Herr Pastor, and that the pastor is the one that does the saving of the congregation as opposed to the
pastor. Why do you think they do that? Why does the lay person do it?
Take responsibility.
Yeah, you escape responsibility. That's your job, pal. Palrette. Marge, what do you say? What's your role for?
I have no idea.
How long have you been married early?
Subservient wife, you know.
I thought it was the same cleaning bill.
Yeah.
I think there was modeled after the monk's robe, wasn't it?
I suppose. But my idea from across the years was just to cover up suits. You don't worry about looking at good quality, bad quality, or nothing. My successor in Texas, we began a mission there, was a very aloof sort of prestigious person from Minneapolis. You've heard of it. And one day at the Trinity Church in Texas, he had the service. It was very hot. They didn't have air conditioning yet. He only had a pair of shorts underneath the garment. Now, if you knew the guy, this is funny. It fell off during Holy Communion. He kicked it aside and kept on serving. And I like that, you know. I mean, that was a cover-up. All I'm trying to say is, yes.
I think she's absolutely right. I mean, I've encountered that a lot in the parish as a pastor. People constantly are amazed that I'm a normal person. I mean, their concept of pastors is this thing up here, and if you act like a normal person, they're just kind of like, whoa, I don't know what to do with you. I don't know where to put you in my hierarchy of where folks are.
Well, this is just a carryover from the old church, isn't it? From the days when you wear your mitre if you're a cardinal or whatever.
Or the rough collar from the old Norwegian church.
I think that's how, what you're saying is how maybe 50 years ago, that is what the minister demanded from his congregation.
Is that what, I mean, I don't know what happened 50 years ago. I wouldn't know.
Just my own background and my parents, et cetera. You know, that's how a minister, years ago, the minister was the only one in the church that was educated.
So 50 years ago, the pastors were the ones who
promoted it,
who imposed it upon their parishes.
Absolutely. And I think it's wonderful that it's changed.
Yes, Marge.
It's a remnant from Catholicism, which modeled it after supposedly the robes of Christ, that Christ wore that kind of a garb in those days. And as the church became the Roman Catholic Church and was associated then with the Roman Empire, it demanded, and many of the bishops then became also civil authorities.
Yep.
It became a mark of their authority, and Lutherans kept it up, the Orthodox, Episcopalians, but many churches did not wear robes.
Why did you write a book, The Power of Ordinary Christians? What were you trying to say?
Because I was asked to write it.
Why did Augsburg Fortress ask you to write it?
Well,
don't you have sympathy for me?
Yes, I do. has a hard life. That's why he developed his sense of humor. Well, because both of us observed that where the church is growing rapidly is where lay people take responsibility for witness and ministry. And in the places where the clergy are dominant, lay people often let them have the, the total responsibility.
Yes. What she's saying is don't let them have authority. Like that.
Well, I didn't
like that. Like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not open, but the Methodist ministry we had in the last church we went to before we know, wore white collar and dressed up just like the priests. And he maintained complete authority in the church.
Yep.
And went down. And the man that's there now comes in a suit, and maybe not even a suit, a sport coat and whatever. And he acts just like anybody else, the friendliest guy, and that place is growing like crazy.
Yeah.
Well, isn't it also a symbol of your office and your job?
Yes,
more just
exactly.
Casually, but you're doing
what
you're doing, just like the nurse has a cap on
yep.
her head,
and
she's a nurse.
I knew an Iowa pastor country who wore a suit all summer with a stock. Practical, fine. But we just heard when we came a story about one of the bishops of our synods who tried to impose himself on selecting the pastor for the church. And the president of the congregation said, keep your hands off, it's our privilege. And he backed off. It's kind of interesting. I don't say that evilly, I just say, you got to know where the authority is so that you don't lose it. I think pastors should be models of Christ, and that's, of course, an impossible thing. But I mean, the story that sticks to my mind is the Quaker called Rufus Jones, magnificent person. When he was old, before he died, was asked, what is the most important moment of your life? Oh, he said, that's easy, he said. My son Lowell was 10. He was playing baseball on the field. I happened to be behind the seats. He couldn't see me. And somebody asked him, what do you want to be when you grow up, Lowell? And he heard his son say, just like my dad. And his son died that year. And someone said, what have you done with your life since then? He said, I've been trying to be the man my son thought I was. Now I think you try to be the man Jesus thinks you are, woman. You know, boy, you don't touch the... One of the famous Japanese Christians wrote a banner, painted a banner. Jesus walked around doing good, period. I find myself just walking around. You see, the model tries to be. And modeling is one of my points, but I'll just put it in here. Modeling is terribly important. May I just give you two, to me, horrifying examples. There was a man called Gandhi who came to England and studied, got a doctorate. And when he studied, he could hear, he said, the faint rustling of the garments of Christ at his elbow. He was ready to give Jesus his life. On the way home to India, he stopped in Africa, came by a white church, and they were worshiping Jesus. And they turned him out. He couldn't get in. So he lost his connection with Jesus. He took his theology, 5th, 6th, and 7th chapters of Matthew, Sermon on the Mount. He lived his ethic, but he never took the cross to India. India might have become Christian. 900 million potentials. There was a student in China studying, I think, at a Presbyterian school. He fell in love with the missionary and somewhat in love with Jesus. But the missionary left and he left the compound. He heard he was back in Beijing. He came to the hotel and the guard said he doesn't want any chinks in here. You know who it is? Mao Zedong. If somebody had modeled Jesus, Let me quote you Nathan Pusey. Nathan Pusey was a president of Harvard, one of the deep evangelicals. In the depth of every mystery, Jesus puts a human face. That's the ultimate mystery. He gives them top billing. He sees in their eyes the very image of God. He is totally serious about them. They fascinate him. They have the qualities he wants. We and they are special. The person next to me is Jesus. What happens to apartheid? The person next to the black may not be. Anybody?
Empathy.
Empathy. Good. What does that mean?
Somebody else's pain.
Somebody else's pain. So where does this settle? Sometimes the Bible translates it pity. That's an awful word. What happens to you if you've got compassion?
You care.
You hold guts for you all. Yeah. That's the quality of Jesus. Is that the quality of our society? Corporate takeover, is that compassion? Someone on the 30th floor New York skyscraper decides to cut off 50 businesses that they own and slices them off without talking to anybody that he employs. You know, that's murder in the morgue. I remember once on a plane I read a Fortune magazine that said, uniquely in America, it's only bottom line. We're totally capitalistic, deceived and controlled by it. In France, it said if a company decides or thinks about moving, they call in the employees' leaders, and 50% of the decision power is in the hand of the laborer. It's us. Which is the most important, the investment of money or investment of persons?
Depends on which side of the fence you're on.
Okay, so let's find the fence for it. But if you're Christian,
person.
I would think person. But we sense that, remember, we have a Getty Museum not far from us. Remember, Getty once had a nephew who was picked up by some people in Europe and held for bondage, and he asked them for a few dollars. He wouldn't give it. He died leaving $3 or $4 billion. He left it to a museum. He had a museum built just a few blocks from his home. He never saw it. He died without anything visible. And now, they have to spend $80 million, $100 million, $200 million, $500 million. Well, 10% of $3 or $4 billion. They have to spend, there's a limitation below which you cannot drop. So they're out buying every other museum on the globe. They're building a new museum in about 10 years, just maybe 5-6 miles from the one that they own now. It'll be superly massive. I figured out, estimated, that every guest that comes to see the museum now, it must cost the fund about $34. It's free. You just call up and get a free. So he left something beautiful, but in the process, he had nothing. Because he had no visible signs of compassion. Compassion is a sign of the presence. From Matthew 9, and Jesus went about all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues, and preaching the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every disease and every infirmity. When he saw the crowds, his guts wrenched for them, because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but laborers are few. Pray, therefore, the Lord of the harvest to send out other people who have wrenching guts." Right? Yeah. Eli Wiesel talks about the three that were hung by the Nazis. Two men and a 14-year-old boy. And the 14-year-old boy didn't die for, I don't know, 20 minutes. He slowly strangled, and somebody in the crowd screamed, "Where's God?" And somebody said, he's in the noose with the boy. He's the in the noose with the boy. They were hanging him. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. We did see him stricken and smitten by God in the thick. Surely he has borne all of them. My first trip to Japan, down at the beach, I saw this little woman, never forgotten it, picking up bricks in one of those neck yokes, and just a small body, she lifted it off the wharf and ran with it. And I remember what John the Baptizer said about Jesus, "Behold the Lamb of God who lifts up and takes away the sins of the world." Yeah. That's compassion. Somebody gets in underneath the burden. And you see this all through the Bible. The widow of Nain, he didn't know him. Says he had compassion on him. She didn't say a thing. You know? Or the men that lowered that man from the ceiling when they ripped over somebody else's roof. Lowered him in the midst of him. And they didn't say a word. He healed him. The president of Carleton said, "The greatest threat to the world are not bombs, missiles. When people no longer care, when spiritual forces die, when the passion for humans cease." The next is to communicate, to speak. How do you speak? How do you communicate?
Body language.
Body language. Very good. More. To make it more explicit.
Eyes, touch.
Eyes, touch, words. Yeah. If you say, "I love you," you know. It's an intriguing thing that in the first verse in Acts, it says, this is what Jesus began to do and to teach. What does that mean?
He practiced it first.
Then he spoke. He won their love, their affection. He approached them with an act. He didn't say, "You're a good guy, bad guy, evil. Are you a homo? Are you an AIDS patient? Are you a drop-off? Are you a killer?" In my home state of North Dakota. What happened to my North Dakota state?
Over here.
Oh, yes.
Over here.
Yeah, the chaplain at the prison said 90% of all the inmates were child abused. Therefore, all of them were, some couldn't surface it. Therefore, who are the persons that should be behind the bars and the penitentiary? You and me. Yeah. We are the human race that abused people and produced criminals. I mean, you push it far enough. Yeah. Tell me the story often. I forget so soon. The early dew of morning passed away by noon. And you got to say it again and again. And you got to live it first and then say it. So one backs up the other. And it's amazing how one little word can change a life. I was thinking this afternoon about Charlie. He'd been to our church. We had a large church, about 3,600. So I didn't see him. He was a Catholic by birth, but he was non-church. And he came to our church in the spring and then didn't show up until fall when he took two of his daughters out to Simi Valley north of L.A. And he took one daughter, got on her horse, and she rode the afternoon. He brought her at 1, came back for her at 5:30. She was about 14. He came back for her, and the horse was standing with the bridle down. And there was no visible sign of her. He found her in the grass. She'd been stabbed 7 times. She was loved in school. Forest Lawn had the largest crowd that they've ever had in history. After the service, I was very busy, and I had a consultation at 5, and he came with letters from students, and we stood there in the hall. For some reason, the Lord says, "I never leave a person that I'm talking to in my office." I left the person that I was talking to in my office, and there he was in the hall. And I said, "Hello, Charlie. Really sorry about this." "Yeah," I said, "I missed you around." "Yeah," I said, "I guess I've been playing golf." He said, "Yeah. But you know, I said, no, this wasn't something profound. I said, you know, we've got to together try to build a world where there won't be people like the one that killed your girl. And the shutters came off his eyes. I've seen hundreds of people converted, but this was unique. He stuck his hand out and said, this is the beginning of a long and wonderful relationship. You know, a stranger from Galilee. In 3 years, he was president of the congregation. Yeah. That you communicate what God puts on your spirit, see. It may sound stupid, you know, but you ask, Lord, help me today to speak to someone, to communicate what you are, who you are, what it means. Not just surface stuff. Memorize athletic stuff and code all that stuff. It doesn't matter, hill of the beans down the pike. But to memorize something that's meaningful, significant. Men, I think, are much less communicative of values and significant stuff than women, right? Women are closer to life, to warmth. When men meet, they talk about, you know, golf. Women talk about kids and caring and loving. And all of us have to do a lot more of that. A single word can change. And we try to share the deep things of God. I was much more on fire when I was a kid than now. I tried to be when I had my neck broken years back. As a kid, I used to pick up everybody, talk to everyone, waitresses, whatever they were, try to win them first, and then try to talk about Jesus, hitchhikers by the dozen. And I think we ought to recapture this. You know, at the end of the day, ask, whom have I spoken to significantly today? It doesn't always have to be weighted with Jesus, but weighted with loving concern that they like what they hear. Any comment? Communication. And if you communicate, what do you want with your circle? You want it to grow. As you dance around this circle, you want it to become an enlarged fellowship. It's Christ's ultimate dream. He wants everyone to be saved and to come into the knowledge of the truth. His passionate prayer, thy kingdom come. Kingdom is a horrible word. It's really a realm. The reign of Jesus. That he's in control. He wants it over everybody. Polls show that 89% of people want to be wanted. Even Nietzsche, before he died, said if he found a living Christian, he might listen. And Thielicke, brilliant German theologian, said something very lovely, I thought. He said, a Christian should be like a basketball player with one foot pasted against the altar and the other foot pivoting. What are you pivoted for? Basketball.
Position.
What are you trying to do?
Pass it
to anyone you can find open. Yeah, you're alive to everybody on the whole squad. You pivot so you keep alive. What's moving? Whom can I touch today? Kind of beautiful, you know? You enlarge the circle. I was in Japan with the Air Force as the visiting preacher, leaving it on an assignment in the Philippines. The Air Force notified the pilot that he wanted to have a message brought to me. Will you come and share with 86 chaplains? They got them together overnight. So I spoke to 86 chaplains when I got there before my other assignments. But also a Quaker came from the Midwest, who said something I've never forgotten. He said, every word that Jesus used to define himself, like light, salt, leaven, have one thing in common. What is it?
Do with food.
Eat. Light?
No light.
Could be, I'm not questioning. More.
Nature.
Leaven, what does it do?
Raises the
brain. Well, how does it do that?
Yeast grows.
Permeates. Gas.
Forms
permeates. It permeates it. Light permeates darkness. Leaven permeates. He says you are to permeate the society. Subtly, any way you can. By words, by letters, by calling, by conversations, by witnessing, by listening and watching the eyes and dancing with your neighbor and making your life radiant where they like to copy you. You know. I've lost on that one. The other thing I discovered around those air bases is that everyone has a building on the sidelines called the Air Rescue Squadron. What are they for? It really moved me.
Help people.
What are they? How do they help people?
If there's a crash or something, they go out and get them.
These are specialists who are trained in everything. Scuba diving, swimming, moving through ice, putting out fires, flipping in to save people from anything, everything. They can never rise high in the service. It's a servanthood. But on every one on the entrance is the insignia, we serve that others may live. Now that you can paste over your door. We should march. We haven't done that. We serve that others may live. And that's the dream of this enlargement group. We should pray for each other. Does that help? Why?
Well, because the Lord hears our prayers.
Well, why does he do it when he loves us in the first place? Why does he want us to pray?
He wants us to be connected.
Connected, more.
Shows you care.
Shows you care, more. Why does he want us to pray, thy kingdom come, your reign come? It doesn't come without us. Why are we important?
We're the salt and messengers.
Yes. What are you besides?
God's children.
More than that.
Serving the kingdom.
If it says, you look at your neighbor, says this Dr. Pusey, you see the face of Jesus. Who are you?
Jesus.
You're Jesus. The only Jesus most people are going to see. Frightening, isn't it? Paul says, I bear in my body the brand marks of Jesus. He said, I try to be like him, try to show that he's marked me with his life. It's kind of awesome when you think of it. But that's what he asks of us. And when we pray, we permit his energy to flow through us into other people. Like Paul writes to 34 people, he mentions in the letter to the Romans, the last chapter, 16th, half of them he'd never seen. But he prayed for them without stopping. When I had my neck broken, I prayed all night for people, and the Lord loaded my memory with names that I'd never thought of for years. People I never prayed for. I prayed all night long. I'd never done that before. I thought of Jesus who did it night and day. I learned something from that experience. You become part of the propulsion of the kingdom. You provide energy that flows through you to other people. It works. You know, they say we have a geist around us and a what? Not a halo, but energy. Mass?
Aura.
Even pigs do, don't they?
Aura.
Even pigs?
No doubt.
No doubt. They would if they worked with you. That was a compliment.
Well, if I worked with them.
Oh boy. No, when four of you have come and talked about the healing service, something happened to you. Why should something happen when some idiots touch you? Because the Lord said you would work through human beings. You pick up a baby that's screaming and the baby stops screaming. You know, there's warmth and wonder and energy that flows. You share your gifts. What are the gifts the Bible talks about? Anyone?
Love.
Well, it's gifts of the Spirit in 1 Corinthians 12 and 14. What are some?
Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness.
That's 13th chapter, dear. You marvel to memorize that. But the gifts of the Spirit, like gifts of wisdom, knowledge. It doesn't say knowledge. Utterance of knowledge, it says. Knowledge not for your own sake, but just share. That's the gift. If you got it in your head, we had a prophet college who had 6 doctorates. He was an imbecile. He was really so bad they had a canon in the first semester. No, he was not our school, one place I know. So I say, it's the utterance of knowledge that you are able to share it. The utterance of wisdom, faith, healing, distinguishing spirits, tongues and the interpretation of tongues, prophecy, revelation, teaching, all those are gifts. If you're a good teacher, it's a gift of God. Can you brag about a gift? No. That's why everyone's equal. If you got a gift and you're better than somebody else, that's a gift you can't brag. I wrote down that remarkable word meek in the Bible. It always fascinates me because blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. And that's one of the gifts of the Spirit. But meekness in French means debonair. I wrote down some of the words. It means cool. Is that mod? Controlled, balanced, poised, ultimate person. The ultimate person. You're way out. Hopeful. Cheerful. Optimistic. Blithe. You got it together. High-spirited, light-hearted, laughing in the circle. Jaunty, buoyant, spirited, sparkling, all alive. Wow. Those are gifts of the Spirit. You delight in each other. Another gift. The quality of delighting. If you marry, what's the best quality to polish to make your marriage significant?
Servitude.
Servitude. What does that mean?
You serve your wife.
Serve your wife. That's beautiful. Okay. If you both work, who should do the housework?
Share.
Share. The newlyweds today, that's very logical. Most of them accept that. More.
Delight
in each other. That's a beautiful word. Delight in each other. And if you delight in each other, the word that's caught me of late is to win each other. You do all you can to win the other person. Did you ever try that? I'm not going to ask you to answer.
Show your affection.
Yeah. Well, hi there. How do you show your affection?
You have to express it. You have to communicate it. Frenchman said you can't make love from the second story balcony.
I thought that was true of Romeo and Juliet.
They died.
He took her out for lunch. You know what happened? Romeo owed with Juliet.
Oh.
Good Lord.
I never said that.
Is that a gift of the Spirit?
No, I think that's a gift of labor. Awful answer. And that you serve each other. Yes. Extend yourself to the other person. And that's sort of the thought that I had in this dream about the circle. Remember that moving story from Midland, Texas? 400 citizens. I mean, yeah, 400 citizens in Midland when Jessica fell into the well. Listen to this. They all 400 converged on Jessica's near tomb. One said, no one has arms long enough to reach her. So they joined arms and focused on someone who needed their love. Isn't that the dancing circle? They called to liberty, just reached out. They were always doing good. On the prowl, but they all reached out and together they did what they couldn't do alone. And they pulled her to safety. Just think if the whole world were like this, all matched together, all arm in arm, all touching each other. I had something I wanted to read from our little book on marriage to remind myself that I ought to be. Create your own parade. They found everything just as Jesus had told them. Jesus never blamed anyone else for what happened to him. He took responsibility for his own actions. He decided to whip the money changers in the temple. He decided to go to Jerusalem. He laid down his life. Having made up his mind, no one could direct him, divert him from this course of action. In Luke's account of Palm Sunday, we see that Jesus even created his own parade. He told two of his disciples where to find the colt and what to do with it. When the crowd saw the disciples throwing their garments on the road in the path of the Lord, they got the idea and the parade was on. Jesus seemed to be saying that even with a cross looming ahead, praise and celebration were possible. It's so easy to blame our troubles on others, our parents, our partners, our environment, our childhood, our poverty, or whatever. Maybe you have to create your own parade. How about eating hot dogs by candlelight? Throwing an autograph my broken leg cast party? Or run barefoot in a park? Don't sit around waiting for someone to do something nice for you. Create your own parade. That's what it means. Delight in each other. Have fun. Develop qualities. Win each other. And then struggle to be a model. We mentioned that. Be a friend. What is a friend? Anyone?
Someone who cares.
Someone who cares. More.
They're a good listener.
Good listener.
Who will be there all the time.
Will be there all the time.
And they're willing to share with you.
Willing to share with you.
Won't pass judgment.
Forgiving.
They do something for you without you having to ask for it.
Good. Now, if we are counseled to have gifts of the Spirit, who are the ones who help us realize we have them? If you had the gift of wisdom, how would you know it?
Somebody else identifies it for you.
Yeah. And what do they do if their lovers really care about you? They help you polish it. You polish your gifts. I think that's awesomely important. That's why lay people are the ones who know each other and can sense what other persons in the parish have. Why don't you do this? Why don't you suggest this? Why don't you touch this? Why don't you see this as a need? Just suggest it to them, because you're the ones that can identify these potentials and help them to become what you're meant to be. Or, can you think of any friend that's helped you? Can someone share? Someone that really came in the nick of time and helped you to become you, besides your parents, but you can mention them if you wish.
I had a friend that I had a business that when it went broke, and I was out of work and I was also out of a place to live, he got me a job and let me live with him for 8 months. Really turned my whole life
around. Yeah. Beautiful.
I have my cousin that I know that I can call on her at any time. And I call her my angel because she's there when I need her.
Angel means messenger of God. That's beautiful. Yeah. Anybody else?
I had a college professor I was having difficulty with chemistry, and I had finished one course, and I tried to take my second course from the same professor from which I had the first, and he refused to have me. He took me next door to, the man's name was Dr. Weaver, and I simply told him that I was having a bad time, and that I really was very ignorant in the subject, and he couldn't hack having me for another quarter. And this is true. I was so amazed. I was shocked from what he was saying. And Dr. Weberg stood and listened, and he thanked Dr. Parishow, and he took me into his office, and he said, I have two desks here. He said, the first thing we'll do is, that's your desk, the second one. And he said, whenever I am not busy, I will help you. And he said, you don't have to go anywhere else to study any of your other subjects. You just study your other ones. And when you need me, we'll arrange when I'll tell you when I'm free. And so he That's simply what we did. And he gave up every lunch hour, the whole quarter. He gave up time before and after classes. He gave me, I never counted the hours. He just gave me, I think, thousands of hours.
Is that?
I even remember very graphically him holding an egg salad sandwich together with one hand and leaning across the little distance between the two desks and showing me how to do the equations. I'm almost haunted still, and I'm out of college for a long time. All that that man did to me, to me, for me.
You can tell him in heaven, take a couple of thousand years.
Yeah. That's just beautiful. Amazing.
Beautiful. Anybody else? One more.
I have a teacher in high school.
Can you hear her? Louder.
I had a teacher in high school who, my senior year of high school was a real rough year as far as two deaths in the family and the beginning of a divorce. And he was a history teacher in my high school, and he was one of the very few teachers who had the patience and who cared enough about these kids in high school to listen to them when they had problems. And he would give up his lunch hours as well and invite, you know, maybe 3, 4, or 5 students would come and just talk in his lunch hours, you know, or, you know, if they happened to match with their own lunch hours. And he really got me through that year as far as just having someone apart from all of my troubles that I could go talk to who listened to what I had to say rather than just try to, he didn't try to explain it, he didn't try, he just listened. And it was a big help.
Beautiful. Well, quickly, we have to finish. In Luke 10, read it sometime, discover something amazing. When the disciples out the first time, they came back just whooping it up. They said, we have done something for you, Jesus, and they came back with radiant joy. And you know what it did? It turned him on. Jesus went into ecstasy. And he said, Father in heaven, I thank you. So you can move Jesus. Next, your potential giants, that's what the saints have always said. Every single human being is a potential giant. Test it and discover it. And ultimately, keep the dance going.